This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
As bad as it seems, the solutions are even not that drastically. Some of these solutions are not so, you know, difficult at all. Just simply do as others do, nothing so exceptionally, and it would go a long way towards solving many of America's problems.
Last week on Sea Change Radio, we heard from renowned energy expert Václav Smil as he spoke about his latest book, Energy Transitions, the future of electric vehicles, and why he has largely avoided the media spotlight up till now. This week, part two of my discussion with Professor Smil, as we discuss the ins and outs of fossil fuel, from peak oil to the Alberta tar sands and natural gas fracking, as well as some possible ways to help solve America's energy puzzle. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Václav Smil. He's currently a distinguished professor in the Faculty of Environment at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada, and he's written very extensively on energy and environmental issues since 1976. Václav, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much.
Because you live and work in Winnipeg, I'm sure you get a lot of tar sand and shale-related questions, but in your estimation, how competitive are these fuels purely from a return on energy investment standpoint, disregarding, for the sake of this conversation, the environmental concerns?
Well, they still are, you know. So, of course, it's less naturally, you know, because, you know, you don't have a liquid to deal with. You have to have a solid, you know. But they still are, even in the case when you have to, this is the oldest way, so way dating back to late 1960s, which is now becoming less and less important, that is mining them and heating them and squeezing the oil out of it. This is becoming now a minority way how to produce them. We are now producing them on site, right? And you heat them underground, and it oozes, and you pump it, right? So that's much better energy efficiency there. And we are constantly working on it, so there is lots of technical improvements to be done there. But even with this crudest way how to do it, just simply mine it. You've seen these huge trucks truck it into these facilities, heat it, literally wring that oil out of it. It still is a pretty good return, really, because what you get out of it is the most energy density fuel in practice which we can use. You know, it's oil, 42 gigajoules per ton, compared to 20 gigajoules per ton for coal which we burn in power plants, and compared to 15 gigajoules per ton for wood, really. So this is still a very high energy density fuel, and of course it has. It has a higher energy cost attached to it and much higher environmental cost, but still, you know, it works. And in fact, you know, you people are one of the major beneficiaries of it, because tar sand oil, or oil sands oil, is now half of Canadian production of oil, crude oil. Half is the traditional, half is the tar sands oil, and half of our production is sold to the United States. So you might think, really, you know, that you are the principal beneficiary of it. And something which most Americans don't know. I'm always, you know, finding it quite amusing, you know, that we've been and we will continue to be your number one supplier of crude oil. Not Iraq or Saudi Arabia or Venezuela or Libya, heavens. It's Canada always.
We actually just did a piece a couple of weeks ago on Sea Change Radio profiling the push and pull between water interests and oil interests, this heavy crude that they have in the largest oil-producing county in California, Kern County, California. You've written quite a bit through the years about peak oil. First, why don't you just tell our listeners what the term means and maybe what your current stance is on peak oil?
Well, it's very simple. If you could apply to anything, you could have peak copper or peak coal. There are resources in the Earth's crust, and of course, they are finite. Right? So that will come a year in national terms or county terms or global terms, when actually say, well, this is it. This is my peak production, and from now on it will come down, right? And And so it's an undeniable phenomenon. It happened many times locally. Local resources have been exhausted, and you know, you just look at it, there's a hole in the ground and there is nothing to mine in that particular country or region or a state. And now we are talking about many of these things in global terms. So people talk about the global peak oil that, let's say, whatever year X certain 2015 will produce 90 whatever 2 million barrels, and that will be it and never anymore, and then it will go down. And now you can start playing with this idea. You can say, so what, right? And so people say, well, this will be the end of the world. So many of these extreme peak oilers say the oil will peak and then the oil production per year will go down, and this is the end of Western civilization because we are bound to these fossil fuels so much, and you know, we've got to drive and heat our houses. No matter that we heat houses in Europe and North America mostly with natural gas, you know, no matter that we could drive with natural gas, you know, it can, it's a very small adjustment to change a car from oil to natural gas. Of course, you know, you wouldn't have a 500-mile range, but, you know, for the driving around, it would be okay. But still, people fear that. So there is this school of thought saying peak oil production goes down globally, lights out for Western civilization, and forget about the poor Chinese or Indians. They'll never get to where we are. I have a very different interpretation of this. A, there are a great many opportunities, as we were saying a while ago, to cut down on that consumption of that oil, and hence inevitably to delay the time of that peak oil, really. Number two, of course, is that you know, oil is substitutable. As I always say, whatever you can do with oil, you can do with natural gas, except for flying. And so we should have been in the business of substituting oil for many, many decades. There is no reason why every fleet vehicle in every big city, all buses, all taxis, all trucks, which, you know, UPS and milk and newspapers, whatever, they all should have been running on natural gas forever. And these are tens of millions of vehicles around the United States, and they run all day long, and they do a great mileage, right? So, plus, of course, you know, you could choose more vehicles to begin with. In Europe, many European countries, 40, 50, 60, 65% of vehicles are diesels, which are 20 to 30, 35% more inherently efficient than gasoline fuel cars. So we can extend the fuel which we have by, you know, doing some smart things. Then, of course, we are constantly extending that amount of the fuel in that crust which we can lay our hands on. That is, we are constantly, through technical innovation, translating resources into reserves. Now, quite, resources are finite. There is a finite amount of oil in the ground, or natural gas or crude oil. But, you know, you are familiar with a perfect example of natural gas. 10 years ago, there was a panic in the U.S. saying, you know, we are running out of our natural gas. We have to start importing liquefied natural gas. Right? And you know what happened then. Right? We went into shale gas, horizontal drilling, fracturing the horizontal strata, which tightly held natural gas. They released the gas, you know, and now the U.S. has, at the current rate of consumption, more than 100 years of reserves of natural gas. So we, out of the resource of natural gas in shales, which was just a resource, but not a reserve 10 years ago, we didn't know how to get it out, we made it into reserve, into very abundant reserve. And you look at the gas prices, right? Oil prices are rising every day by a dollar or two over, and you know what's happening to gas prices? Steady or lower, right? At record lows. Gas has been never, never cheaper in terms of disposable income than it is right now. So, you know, this is what happening actually also with oil. And what we were talking about a while ago is an example, right? 50 years ago, oil in tar sands was just a resource. It wasn't a reserve. We didn't know how to get it out. Now, half of Canadian oil and half of it being exported to the U.S. is coming from these things, which now became reserves. And, you know, there is about as much there or more than is in Saudi Arabia. And there is plenty of shale oil around the world. Canada is not the only place. And there is plenty of tightly held shale gas around the world. You know? So I just would advise all these people who think that, you know, that suppose the oil production will peak, classic oil production from liquid oil will peak whatever, you know, may have peaked already or will peak this year, whatever. So what really, right? This is not the end of Western civilization, by no means.
Well, and apocalyptic fears aside, a lot of people think that if we have already gone through that peak or we're in the midst of a peak, you probably are familiar with the work of Matthew Simmons, who in his book Twilight in the Desert, he tries to uncover the real reserves in Saudi Arabia. And now that we're pumping record amounts of water into these great Saudi oil fields, that it kind of shows that as a red flag for peak oil. But a lot of people think, well, this could be a good wake-up call for an accelerating the kind of energy transitions you write about.
Well, let me tell you about Simmons in the first place. And Simmons in Saudi Arabia, it's a particularly interesting thing, you know. At that time, when he was writing how Saudi Arabia is totally out of it and they are just, you know, it's more oil than water, Saudis were investing tens of billions of dollars to increase their production by about 30 to 40%. Now, you know, would they be that stupid investing tens of billions of dollars if they would not have known that they do have that actually that oil out the ground? Of course they wouldn't, right?
The age of cheap oil is gone. So people aren't necessarily saying all the oil's gone. They're just saying it's going to cost more and more to extract this oil.
Exactly. You know, so it used to, in Saudi Arabia, it used to cost 20 or 30 cents per barrel to extract it. Now it may cost $4 or $5. That's it, really. Don't forget that bulk of the price of oil has nothing to do with the production cost of oil. Nothing whatsoever. Even the people in the tar sands, they can produce the stuff now for about $25 or $30. Even tar sands, okay, which is the crazy way how to produce oil, right? Most of the oil in Middle East is still produced for less than $10 a barrel, much less than $10 a barrel, right?
And how does that compare to the per barrel costs of the Alberta tar sands?
Easily on the order of 10 times almost. From tar sands, about $30. And from Middle East, let's say $5, $3, $4, $5, right? And, you know, then you have the other thing, of course. Then you have the offshore. You know, people don't like offshore because, you know, the Macondo last year, BP, whatever. So, you know, ban on offshore drilling, whatever. There is tremendous amount of oil offshore. That's, of course, you know, technically more difficult, more complex. And, again, it will be more costly. This is not a cheap oil. And you have to drill, I mean, you know, you have to sink your pipe through 2 kilometers of water before you hit the ground, and then you go down, you know, under sea. So that's an expensive oil. But still, you know, suppose, you know, let's do this mental arithmetic. You know what is the average mileage of a vehicle on American road? And I say vehicle, not a car, because you people, half of the vehicles you drive are not cars now. You drive them as cars, but they are SUVs, vans, pickups, right? And pickup light trucks, right? Okay. So you know what's the average mileage of an American fleet? You take all of these vehicles. You know what the average mileage is here? 23 miles per gallon. Okay. 23 miles per gallon. Honda is now making some very big cars, you know, some of these SUVs, whatever. But if you take the whole Honda fleet, all Honda vehicles, right, which they produce in a year, that average is 34 miles per gallon. Okay? So imagine that if just people would drive different kinds of Hondas, and that includes big cars like Accord and Honda SUVs, you know, from 23 to 34, right away you'd go to 34 miles per gallon. Right? I'll give you even a better example. Between 1975 and 1985, CAFE doubled in the United States from 13.5 to 27.5 miles per gallon. Okay? Take a checkered paper and protract the line from 1985 to 2011. If we would have kept on improving CAFE from 85 to 2011, we stopped CAFE in 1985, right, 85, 86, but it would have been keeping at it, the average American car would be now close to 50 miles per gallon, which technically speaking is no difficulty. I drive a car like that. It's not a, you know, it's not an impossibility. And hybrids are over 50 miles per gallon, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you see, so this thing clearly can put off the day. So suppose I get a gasoline which is double the price, right? Well, you know, if I get a car, now it's 23 miles per gallon. If I get a car 46 miles per gallon, well, I will use only half as much gasoline then, and the gasoline which costs double, it would cost me still the same amount per year, really. So, you know, if you combine higher efficiency with double price of gasoline, you still will be as well off, really. So, you know, we don't have to fear higher oil prices as long as you will become more efficient. You just simply don't drive a big SUV, as simple as that, really, right? So, you know, I'm not, you know, there is no reason to be so terrified of oil peak or high oil prices. It would finally actually force us to act somewhat more reasonably. So actually I wish, you know, I say it, not really, I don't mean it, you know, but I wish we would lose Saudi Arabia, you know, mentally speaking at least, you know, for a while. So we would say, okay, we have to rationally respond to this crisis, because we are not rationally responding to this crisis. As you know, what's happening, that the average weight of American car is still increasing, 1.8 tons, and it's still going up. know, why do you need 1.8 tons to carry a person which weighs 50 to 80 kilograms? Why do you need that really, right? You know, and SUVs are still selling like hotcakes, and as we said a while ago, they sold a couple hundred watts last month, right? So let's not be afraid of high oil prices, because, you know, in whatever and whenever shape the peak oil will be coming, it will be reflected first in higher oil prices. So let's not be afraid of higher oil prices, because higher oil prices will finally make us even more efficient than we have already become, and we have a long way to go in improving the efficiency of everything which is consuming oil.
Rome was not built in a day. Opposition will come your way. But the hotter the battle you see, is the sweeter the victory. Now, you can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and try, try. Succeed at last.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Václav Smil. He's a professor of environment at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. I want to turn back for a second to what you mentioned about natural gas. The EPA here in the U.S. has just been debating the environmental issues surrounding natural gas fracking in Congress.
Yeah.
Do you think fracking is a viable solution, in your opinion?
Well, you know, it's a way how to produce it, and there is a, you know, when you produce fossil fuels, you always have environmental impact. You know, you will not do it without any impact at all. Now, you know, this, you have the stories, right?
But some of the companies behind fracking are saying, don't worry about it, there's no detriment to the environment at all.
No, of course there is. Of course there is. There is an environmental problem with every form of energy production and consumption. And with fossil fuels in particular, but so it is with wind, and so it is with solar, and so it is with hydro energy. Every form of energy extraction and conversion and use has very serious and large environmental impacts. To say otherwise, it's just naive or stupid, really. The question is, as we've done before, really, you know, when we started mining coal, it was all awful, right? You know, black lungs, like in, today in China, you know, thousands of miners dead every year in accidents. Well, you know, we've moved along some way, and we have adequate or reasonably adequate, at least in most cases, in North America, in Australia, mining safety precautions. We've actually, you know, made most of our mining surface mining, so basically it's not a mining, it's a large sort of mass material moving operations, so safety has increased tremendously. The cleanliness of operations has improved. You know, so we are basically, an economist would say, we have added some of those externalities of bad old coal production. So the same opportunities, of course, are here for fractioning shales and from producing natural gas. It will have to be done more carefully, using less water, taking into account the people who complain that, you know, they have a flaming water supply coming from their faucet. You know, so of course there are problems with it. But again, you know, these problems have technical solutions, and it's a very clean source of energy. It's the one which has the least carbon per unit of energy burned, really. So what are the other options, you know? If you want to enjoy the quality of life which we have, and if you think that coal is too dirty, and if the wind and photovoltaics is not progressing rapidly, and if the oil is becoming of a higher price, so what do you do then, you know? You say, oh, the fractioning of natural gas strata has environmental problems, so I will abandon it. No, you work at it, and you come up with better technical solutions. To me, this is the best way to go. But of course, you've got to admit that there are problems associated with it and that you will be trying to address them.
So it's always about finding the lesser of two evils as we move forward to another solution.
Absolutely, because imagine if we would be without all that natural gas, if our, that practically every U.S. house is now, I mean, you know, this is the dominant way how to heat U.S. houses, or Canadian or European, no matter if it's in France or Germany, is natural gas. So imagine if we would yank out that natural gas supply from the U.S. energy supply, and we would have to need even more oil or more coal, right, with much greater environmental impact, with much greater cost, because U.S. would have to be importing much more oil, including the oil from the mad Middle East, right? So absolutely, you know, that's the choice.
And you've written extensively from a rational, sometimes realistic viewpoint. And I should point out to our listeners, your books include Oil, A Beginner's Guide, Energy Myths and Realities, Energy Transitions, Why America is Not a New Rome. They can go to Amazon.com and check out the dozens of writings you've had on energy. But so a lot of these books have been to try to tamper a lot of optimism and expectations for this quick transition into the Wizard of Oz, and everybody's happy, and we have clean energy, and we have silver bullet answers. But what are some of the things that make you most optimistic right now, Václav?
Right now, I'm optimistic about very, very, very little, especially as far as the U.S. is concerned. I think you people have lost it. You've become ungovernable. And when a country becomes ungovernable, it's very difficult to be optimistic.
But in terms of when you look at maybe technology and some of the strides that give you a little extra kick in your step in the morning, you say, hey, that could be something worth pursuing. What are some of the areas that get you most excited?
There is never a shortage of technical fixes. The technical fixes are always there, you know. But as I say, you know, we have cars which are 50 miles per gallon, but, you know, people prefer to buy SUVs still, right? So I think what we need simply is and you know, generally speaking, when things are explained, you know, reasonably honestly to people, people are willing to buckle down and, you know, to be taxed properly and to take some rational steps, whatever. But in the West, we've had such a long period of living above our means and beyond our means that people, I mean, not all, of course, you know, but the great big bulk of people, the 70%, they are so much used to it that they complain about the slightest hardship, like, you know, constant whining about energy costs, extra 3 cents for gasoline or whatever, or, you know, this American fear of increasing taxes, right? You know, you people are in dire financial situation, right? But both parties fear to say, you know, we need to increase taxes. So this is utterly irrational, and this comes from this long period of this irresponsible, irrational, excessive behavior, and that will be very difficult to reverse because you've been acting basically as an addict, addict to overconsumption, addict to deficit spending, and it's very difficult to reverse that. So this is why I'm not so optimistic, because, as you know, treating long-term addictions is not an easy thing. It's doable, but boy, it's not easy.
What do you think some of the best ways to go about getting off of that addiction might be?
Well, as I said, you know, for example, losing Saudi Arabia, so to speak, right? You know, if there will be a real massive increase in oil prices, if there will be a real disruption in the long-term disruption, not for 6 months or so, 6 weeks or 3 months, but, you know, suppose you pose this question in your mind. Suppose that you lose Saudi Arabia. You know, you lose on the order of 10 million barrels of supply out of 80 million plus a day, you know. What the response would be? Well, you know, this wouldn't be the end of the world, but it would require some very, very, very massive adjustment. And I'm afraid that unless we will be confronted by something like that, you know, an equivalent of losing Saudi Arabia, or that we will not voluntarily act to, you know, to enter that path of rationality and kind of, you know, simple, sensible behavior. We'll keep doing this. I was just astonished, you know, when I read this this story today that Steny Hoyer says that we will not balance the budget for next 25 years. We still have a chance to address these things, but nobody is addressing them.
Right.
And so-called responsible leaders are telling us, you know, it will take 25 years to address them now. So it's totally frightening.
Yeah, it is frightening. And as we know more and more about our usage of energy, it can get more and more depressing.
There are always options. There is always hope. But the problem is, especially now, it's always different between Japan and Europe and North America. As similar as these three entities are, they are so different. I know them well, all of them. And they are different in many, many ways. Japanese have much, much lower expectations. You know, they are a consumer society like anybody else now. But, you know, they, until recently, they lived with some real hardships. Your average Japanese family is not your average suburban family from Phoenix, living within, whatever, 10 miles of 10 Walmarts and so on, really, and not walking anywhere. There are not even any sidewalks in that place.
Sure.
Right, you know? So there is always hope. There are always actions. There are always solutions possible. There are always technical fixes. Usually, I classify myself kind of as a realist, sort of, you know, a semi-optimistic realist, whatever. But I'm becoming so pessimistic recently because I do not see even any beginning of willingness to act, you know. Forget about, you know, real willingness to act, but even beginning of the willingness to act. So, you know, this is not, it's even worse than these electric cars. At least, you know, you can go and buy that Volt now. But there is no even responsible decision maker which says, you know, really we need some drastic, really drastic fundamental changes.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Václav Smil. He's a professor of environment at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. So what do you see sparking these kind of fundamental changes?
What I think is most hopeful, actually, that if you look at this, as bad as it seems, the solutions are even not that drastically. If you ask me, what is the single most important thing to do for Americans to get out of many, many of these current problems, you know? Well, you know, this will not take care of everything, but it will take care of a great chunk of these problems. The U.S. is the only country in the Western world which does not have a value-added tax. In Canada, we call it general sales tax, GST, right? U.S. doesn't have it. Imagine if you people would tax yourself through general sales tax as people do in Europe, value-added tax. In most European countries, on the order of 15%, right? Everything you buy, except groceries, right, and essential clothes for children, would be subject to value-added tax, 15%, right? Almost magically, much of the federal deficit would disappear in a matter of 5 years. If you would be just behaving as any other Canadian, Japanese, or German, or French behaves, you know, pay the value-added tax, that's all, really, right, you know? Nothing exceptional, right? You know, nothing torturous, nothing medieval, really, right? You know, just do what other people do, right? You know.
Same thing when it goes to taxing our gasoline, right?
Well, of course, you know, you would be paying, you know, that even in, you see, look, this is the funny thing in Canada, right? We sell half of our crude oil to you, and we have higher gasoline prices than you do, right? Yet we are fully self-sufficient in oil. We are a big exporter, right? And we tax ourselves more as far as gasoline goes than you people, right? But, you know, so this is an example. The value-added tax is an example that some of these solutions are not so, you know, difficult at all. Just simply do as others do, nothing so exceptionally, and it would go a long way towards solving many of America's problems.
I think you're putting your finger on a pretty important lesson, is that Americans are always thinking about some big, drastic thing that needs to be done, and they want to hear that, you know, there's a silver bullet for something, but sometimes the simplest solutions are the best.
Oh, yeah, always. You people have to have a Manhattan Project for everything, right? You know, Manhattan Project to solve it. No, just tax yourself as Germans do, and that's it, right? You know, some people admire Germany and say, oh, look at Germany now, you know, a great, you know, the budget surplus, you know, low unemployment, right?
Why is that?
Huge exports of manufacturing. Well, so do as Germans do, really, right? Pay value-added tax, right? As simple as that, right? You lived in Japan, so you know very well, Japanese do not have a three-car garages, right?
No, they barely have cars. If they have cars, they only have them to take them out for a day or two on the weekends.
You know, the average size of American custom-built house in 2008 hit 5,000 square feet, right? And average size of a mass-built house was 2,500 feet, 2,500 square feet, right? In Japan, it's less than half that size, right? And I always say, in these houses, in this 5,000 square foot house, there are many rooms which those people will never visit.
Yeah, it's absurd.
Think of the lessons of Japan, or think of the lessons of Germany, and think of the fact that simply America will not be able to live as America has lived in past 50 years, you know. It's just simply, you people will have to live more, and we too, everybody will have to live more like Germans or Japanese, you know. The age of great grand American living is over, period.
Well, I appreciate you walking us through some of these very complex topics. Václav Smil, he's the professor of environment at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada, and an author of numerous books on energy and environment. Thank you so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Okay, this is interesting. Thanks, Dave. Bye-bye.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Bomb the Bass, Radiohead, and Desmond Decker. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.